Good morning. So last time we talked about relating caches to actual code we had. So we first went through sort of our most systematic way of counting cache misses given C code. So here we said, okay, given some code, we can figure out what should the cache accesses be. Usually we're concerned mostly about the data cache because that's the thing we have the most control over. And usually has the worse cache misses. And we can say, okay, we know the accesses. We can figure out how to map that to the sets of the cache. Most commonly, we're concerned with arrays because, well, if we're accessing a lot of data, and therefore data cache misses are concerned, probably we have something like arrays. We mentioned we have to worry a little bit about whether the arrays are what we call the line, whether they sort of map up to the cache blocks. And once we figure out sort of a mapping the sets, we can kind of look at each set separately and say, what's the access pattern in each set? And use that to figure out how many misses there are. And this technique works. And this is what we might do in some very simple examples, or like if we're running a simulator, like the one you're going to use in lab tomorrow. This is how we do that. But for more practical use, we probably want something where we're a little faster to estimate how bad things are. So we have this idea for counting misses in an approximate way. And here we've kind of piggybacked on the idea that we can quickly look at whether we have good or bad locality, and that kind of tells us whether we have a miss or not. So if we have like code with loops and the innermost loop axis is like an array, we could say, okay, let's think of what happens between iterations of this loop. If we have an access that's the same as the previous one, there's no chance of a miss, right? So we can kind of exclude misses that way. If it's adjacent, we have good spatial locality, we can say, okay, well, it's a 1 over how many things fit in a block chance of a miss. And only if those two things are in different blocks do we have a problem. And if it's not adjacent or not accessed recently, then, well, it's going to be a miss. And we can use this to quickly estimate how many misses we have. This is approximate. Like, it doesn't take into account that we might have conflict misses from other things we're accessing. It doesn't take into account that things that aren't adjacent might be adjacent to other things that we're looking at in the code. So it's an estimate, but it's a much easier to get estimate, and it gives us ideas of what sort of changes we want to make to our code. And not surprisingly, we learn we want to improve our spatial and temporal locality. And we're going to look more at this idea today. In particular, we're going to look at one transformation that is going to help us improve our spatial and temporal locality called cache block. So questions about things we covered last time. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little about the quiz. So quiz question two. We were asking about having a cache where we improved how fast we can detect whether we have a hit. And the proposal for how that might happen is we'd have a separate storage for the tags that would be smaller and faster to access. So while we were looking at the data, we could look up those tags and do the comparison on them and all that more quickly. And we could infer that the original cache before this optimization, it took the entire hit time to detect a hit. We could infer that because I told you what the average memory access time was. And average memory access time, based on how we used the formula, it said we take 100 extra cycles, the access time for the next level, as our missed penalty. So that's the additional time after the hit time. So we can infer that we didn't even start that next level access until after the hit time. Probably I should have been more explicit, but you could have figured out that we have to have waited until the hit time based on the average memory access time I told you was for the old cache. So for the new cache, basically what we've done, this is the slide I forgot to edit. So this should be a 5. Is that we've changed the miss time from 105 cycles, so the hit time plus accessing the next level, to 102 cycles, the 2 cycles to detect plus access to the next level. So we have 90% of the time, we take 5 cycles, our hit time, And 10% of the time, we take 102 cycles. So that's one way we could have computed the value. Another way is that we could say our miss penalty, instead of being 100 cycles, now it's 97 cycles, because we saved 3 cycles by starting the next level access group. Questions on quiz question 2? So quiz question 3 was asking you to, using the tedious way, because we wanted the exact number, count the number of cache misses this code would have for the accesses to array. That's the only thing which uses our cache. And the first thing I did is I looked at this code and said, what are the indices we access? And we can see that we access when I is 0 and j is 0, we access 0, then 0. I only wrote 0 once because I know the second one's going to be a hit because it's right after we access the same thing. Then 3, then 6, 9, so on. So I just wrote the list of accesses. And then I thought, how does this array map to the cache? And the way the cache was set up, I knew that we'd have 0, 1 together in a cache block, indexes 0 and 1 of the array, that is, then indexes 2 and 3, then indexes 4 and 5, 6 and 7, and so on. And I also knew that if 0 and 1 map to a set, 4 and 5 would map to the same set, and similarly, 2 and 3 would map to the same set as 6 and 7, and so on. So given this mapping, I just simulated the accesses, and I just kept track of what was in each set as we went through. And for the most part, this is straightforward, but we had something weird happen here, where I need to determine where my 4 and 5, or I need to determine, where 4 and 5 went here. How did I determine it replaced 8 and 9 and not 1 and 2? Well, I looked for what was most recently used and least recently used. So the 1, so this set is the most recently used. I should point to the actual value. So at 9, after here, this is the most recently used set because we just accessed 1. So replace 8 and 9 because 1 was just used. And we had an LRD pause. Some questions on how I did this simulation? Yeah.
Why does each block only house 2 parts of the array, 2 indices of the array?
Why does each block only store 2 indices in the array? In the problem, the array had 8-byte blocks, and ints on the systems we care about are 4 bytes. So that's 2 indices. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I'm going to skip over quiz question 4, unless people ask me about it, which you're welcome to do so, but... So quiz question 5. So we wanted to look at the accesses to B in this code. And we wanted to say, okay, what is the access pattern is the first thing I looked at. So the accesses are when I is 1, we access 1. When I is 2, we access 2, then 2. When I is 3, we access 3, then 3, then 3. And an observation I can make here is that for each I, only the first access should be a miss. Because we're at, you know, otherwise... You know, when we access 3 the third time, we've recently accessed 3 before, that should be a hit. And that should be the same for each other I. So only the first access is the one that's a miss. And because our blocks hold 4 elements, there's sort of a 1/4 chance that that first access is not the same block as the thing we just accessed in the previous iteration at the end. So I have a 1/4 chance of them being in different blocks, and I have n different I's. So I have n over 4 misses would be my estimate. This is an estimate because we aren't like taking into account like conflict misses with B and D and all that. But this should be pretty close to the number of actual misses. So questions on how I figured that out? Okay, so then we get to the same question but for the array D. So the access pattern for D is a little more complicated. So we access 1, then 2, n plus 2, 3, n plus 3, 2, n plus 3, and so on. And sort of the general case is when we get to k, we're accessing k, n plus k, 2, n plus k, all the way up to k minus 1 times n plus k. And I think something a lot of you wanted to do is you looked at these early accesses and you said, oh, we have spatial locality. And this is true. We have spatial locality. We should have some extra hits from that. But the thing is that this phenomenon is quickly going to go away. Once k gets pretty big here, we're going to end up with a case that between two iterations, we're going to have a big gap. It's that, yes, we're accessing, things that are next to each other, but we have, k accesses in between, and that k can be pretty large. Like, think of when k gets to like a quarter of n. That's already pretty big because we know none of the arrays alone fit in the cache. So it's not very likely that once k gets to like n over 4 or even n over 8, that we're going to actually be able to take advantage of that spatial locality. So I would say the normal case is that all the accesses to D are going to be misses. We're going to have some special cases at the beginning. We're going to have extra hits. But almost all of them are going to be misses because n is pretty big, so we're quickly going to get to some k value where we're not going to be able to take advantage of that spatial locality anymore. And as far as counting the number of accesses to D, we have about n iterations of this loop and an average of n over 2 iterations of the second loop. So that gives us n squared over 2. Questions, how I figured out that, or other things on the quiz. Okay, so as I mentioned, we're going to look at a particular cache optimization we can make from a writing programs perspective, and this is our preview of what the pattern we're going to look at looks like. And to look at what's happening here, we're going to talk about what's the locality like with this pattern. Then we're going to sort of construct this more consistently. So one thing is I promise you that assuming n is a multiple of 32, these two things compute the same thing. We'll prove that maybe in a more systematic way later. And my question is, which of these has better temporal locality and spatial locality for each of the arrays? A little Kafka, check with your neighbors, see if you agree on what's going on. How does it compare? I'll start with temporal locality in A. Who'd like some more time for temporal locality in A? Okay, so who thinks version 2, the top one, has better temporal locality for A? Thinks version 3, the bottom one, does? Thinks they're about the same? Okay, who has no clue? Two people. Okay, so the way I figured this out is, for the first version, we're accessing 0 n times, index 0 of A, then index 1 of A n times, index 2 of A n times. So this is basically the best we can possibly do for temporal locality. We're accessing 0 over and over again until we're done with 0. We're doing it right away. That's version 2. For version 3, it's more complicated. We're accessing 0 32 times, then 1 32 times, then 2 32 times. And we keep doing that until we get to 31. Then we go back to 0 32 times, and we do that a bunch of times until we advance in this loop over JJ. And then we're going to move on to 32 through 63, and so on. So in version 3, we have temporal locality. We are repeatedly accessing the same thing over and over again in quick succession, but we have some skips around, right? So we have some cases where we're skipping by, you know, we're skipping to the next thing for a while before going back. So it's not nearly as good, but still, like most of the time, in fact, like 31 out of 32 of the time, we're accessing the same thing over and over again. So we have pretty good temporal locality. We are getting repeated use out of elements of A because, you know, like 96% of the time, we're accessing the same thing in A that we did before. And even when we're not, like, even when I stop accessing 0 for a while, it's not nearly as long, not very long until I access it again, because I just have to go through 31 iterations, not like n iterations. So 2 is better, but 3 is still pretty good. So for temporal. 2 is 2, but 3 is still good. Still very good. How about spatial locality in A? Who would like some more time to figure out spatial locality in A? Okay, a few people. If you haven't done B, that's obviously what we're doing next, so. And C. Okay, so spatial locality in A. Who thinks version 2 is better? Thinks version 3 is better? Thinks they're about the same? Okay, so I think our consensus is about the same. I think that's a reasonable assessment because I guess I would say version 2 is probably a little better. So the same kind of idea, but they're pretty close. So in version 2, if we're accessing index I, our prediction of what we're going to access is always the next thing. For version 3, usually that's the best prediction, but sometimes we go from like 31 to 0, which isn't as good. Like those aren't likely to be in the same block of our cache a lot of the time, but it's still very good. So the same thing. So 2 is better, but 3 is still excellent for spatial locality. Okay, so let's do the same question for B. B temporal locality. Let's start with temporal locality for B. Alright, so what's our access pattern for B? Well, it's different. So for B, I should write this somewhere where it doesn't look like it's part of A's. So who thinks the temporal locality for B is better in version 2? Top one. This is better in version 3. Okay, about the same. No clue? Okay, so the access pattern for B in version 2 is 0, 1, 2, 3, all the way up to n minus 1, then back to 0. So our only temporal locality is that we repeat accessing something every n times. And if n is pretty big, that's actually not very good temporal locality. For version 3, we access 0, then 1, then 2, then 3, up to 31. Then we go back to 0. Then we do that again 32 times. Like that's when I is 0, JJ is 0, and then we kind of repeat that with accessing 32 through 63, in that same pattern. So here, we still have some cases where there's big gaps between we access something, some part of B again, but our common case is like when I see an access to say 2, most likely I'm going to access it 32 time steps later, which is a lot sooner than n. So I'd say it's clearly the case that 3 has better temporal locality. Now there's a question of, is that better enough that our cache can take advantage of it? And to answer that question, we need to think of, well, can we fit, do we have enough space in our cache that we're going to have things from 32 accesses, well, 32 iterations of the loop ago? And if our cache is big enough that the answer to that is yes, we're in luck. The answer is no, then we'd end up about the same. Typically, our caches like can store hundreds of things, so 32 iterations of the loop ago will actually be fine. But if our cache was smaller, yes, it would be a problem. Or they'd end up being about the same. So I'd say that for temporal locality, there we are, 3 is a lot better for B. But for 3, if our cache is reasonably large, well, we should be able to take advantage of that temporal locality too. Like it's actually meaningfully more. Questions of how I came to that conclusion? Okay, so how about spatial locality in B? So we know what those access patterns are. Who wants more time for spatial locality in B? Okay, so let's do who thinks version 2, the top one, is better. Version 3, the bottom one, is better. Okay, so most people say 2 is better, and I would agree that with 2, we're always going, the thing we access next is always, after I, is always I plus 1. With version 3, usually it's I plus 1, but sometimes it's, you know, skipping by 32 again. So I think this is actually a repeat of what we had for A. So 2, but 3 is still very good, because usually the temporal locality idea still works. Usually we are accessing the next thing. We have an exception, less than 5% of the time. Okay. And let's talk about C. So for C, for temporal locality, let's start with temporal locality. So who thinks for C, the temporal locality is better in version 2? Version 3, the bottom one, they're about the same. So I would say they're the same because the I's and J's we end up choosing for both are the same set of I's and J's. And we never choose the same I and J twice, same I and J combination twice, which means we never choose the same element of C twice. So there's no temporal locality. We never actually access the same element of C twice. So the temporal locality is none in either, which makes sense because this calculation only accesses each part of C once. But how about spatial locality in C? little bit of time. Who'd like some more time? So who thinks version 2, the top one, has better spatial locality in C? The bottom one, they're about the same. So we have a split between the top one and they're about the same. So I agree, the top one, I think, is better because here the axis pattern for C is 0, 1, 2, up to n minus 1, then n plus 1, and it keeps going. It's always sequential. And the second version, it's not like that, because we do 0, 1, up to 31, and then we do n up to n plus 31, and then 2n up to 2n plus 31, and so on. But I would note that in the second version, it's not as good because we have these skips by n, but we only do that 1 out of 32 times. So it's still pretty good. So most of the time, the next thing we're accessing is adjacent. So this is another case where sort of the top version 2 is bet, 3 is still very good. Or at least still good. So you can see that whatever transformation I did to get from version 2 to version 3 here, I dramatically improved my locality for B, and in the process, I compromised the other locality, but not very much. So in practice, we'd expect the bottom version to be faster, because we should have more overall cache misses, sort of cache hits, because we've basically overall improved the locality, we're basically dug out some more locality for B in a way where, unlike when we were looking at sort of loop reordering, we didn't have to like totally break the locality for A and C. Some questions. This example here. Okay, so I'm going to look at this kind of idea. I'm going to look at it with our matrix multiply example, where we looked at loop orders last time. So last time we settled that this loop order looked like pretty good. We were like thinking about playing around with the order of K, I, and J. We chose this order worked out pretty well. I'm going to do a little transformation to this. My first step of my transformation, I want to convince you I haven't changed anything, assuming n is even. That all I'm doing here is I'm taking that loop over k and splitting it into two pieces. But this should compute the exact same thing. I just have a funny way of writing a loop over k. Some questions about this transformation here. Okay, so our next step is going to be that, just like when we started out, I like changed the order of these loops and said because addition's commutative, it shouldn't change what we calculate. I'm going to do a change of the order of these loops, where I'm going to move this new loop here to the inside. So that's not going to change what we calculate, it's just going to change the order in which we do it, which is going to change our locality. So I end up with code like this, and this code, this new version, is going to have some different locality. And kind of the comments hint at what that locality might look like. And a way that might make it easier to understand what's going on is I'm going to expand this loop. This loop has two iterations. I'm just going to write out both of those iterations. So that looks like this. So I've just taken my version with that loop over k, based on kk, and I've just expanded it, just written out the code for both of the iterations of the loop. And we can see that now we have temporal locality that we didn't have before. particular. Now I'm using something from C twice, where in the original version, I only had basically the first line there, so I used something from C once. I also have spatial locality with A, where in the original version, I didn't have that. I was always skipping by N and A. Now I'm not. Now I have some spatial locality in A, so that should be better. And you might say, well, gosh, but in doing this, we made B worse. So B, we're skipping by N when we weren't before. But since I only have two things in B I need to keep in the cache, that shouldn't be a problem. That, yeah, I have, like, more things of B to keep in the cache, but the cache has room for two blocks of B instead of one, and that's sort of all I'm asking here. That as long as I can keep the two blocks of B in there, it doesn't matter that I'm not accessing quite adjacent, they should still both fit in the cache. But I obviously can't keep doing this indefinitely, but the cache has some amount of space. So having these two things that are from B far apart shouldn't be a big issue. And we can kind of think of how this worked with our miscounting idea that we started did last time. That I went to do the sort of estimate how many misses we have in this new version. So let's do that. We're going to start out by reminding us what we had for the old version. Before we transform K, we learned that, oh, for A, each time we have this loop over J, we access one element of A, that's one miss, times n squared iterations, so n squared misses. For B, each time I have one of these loops, I access a new element of B, and about 1 over the block size, the number of elements in a block, that's in the same block as the previous iteration, so that's n to the cube, n cubed, the number of iterations of the innermost loop, divided by the block size misses. And the same was true for C. So questions on these numbers from last time? Before we try to think about what's the calculation look like now? Okay, so this is from last time, and now let's do our new calculation. We'll start with A. So for the old version, we had a new element of A accessed every time we had a new loop over J, gave us n squared misses. For this version, every time we have a loop over J, we're accessing two elements of A, a pair of elements. But this pair of elements are in the same cache block. So we expect one miss per those two elements. So there's one miss per those two elements, and the number of times we have that loop is n over 2 divided times n. Why n over 2? Because this loop here, this outer loop, is n over 2 times. And this loop here is n times. So we end up with n over 2 times n misses total. So less than we had before. We had n squared before. Now we have n squared over 2 because we're loading in pairs. And you might say, gosh, we could probably have loaded more than pairs and gotten this back. So questions on the calculation for K. Okay. So let's do the same calculation for B. So for B, we're accessing a pair of values, but these times the pair isn't in the same block. That's not so great. So that means that time, I should write this. Each time, except, you know, same block as the previous iteration. So usually, if we think of consecutive accesses, we're going, you know, to B 0 times n plus 1, and B 1 times n plus 1. So usually we'll have spatial locality still with our accesses. So we should have hits from things being in the same cache block, but we still have two different cache blocks, So we expect each of those accesses, the first time it's a new thing in that block, to be a miss. So we expect sort of the number of misses to be, we have to load two rows in the narration. I mean, it's the number of cache blocks we scan through in two rows. So another way of looking at it is that this loop here is that for one J loop, we load two rows of B. Right, that's what we're doing. We're loading it sequentially, and so we end up having a miss to each block of those rows. We only have one per block because we already have spatial locality within the room. Some questions on how I come to that conclusion? So we end up with, I guess I should say per J loop, to be clear. With each iteration, and per iteration, we have a 1, we have a 2 divided by the block size miss rate. And the 2 comes from us having two things that are in different blocks that we need to worry about. But we divide by the block size because they're usually in the same blocks as the two things we accessed in the previous iteration. And so we end up with saying, oh, we have 2 n misses per that loop, but we have half as many of the loops because remember we're doing k, the outer k is plus equals 2, not plus equals 1 anymore. So we end up with nq divided by block size, which is the same number we had before. So we have one more case, which is C, which I don't have a slide for, but for C, if we think of how that works, we're accessing the same thing twice. So we have one miss for a new access for every time we have a new iteration of the J loop. But we have half as many iterations of that because we're skipping k by 2. So I end up with half as many misses as we had before. So what we ended up doing is we improve the number of misses we expect for A and C. And based on the fact that we thought, oh, I can store 2 different blocks of B pretty easily, we didn't expect any change in the number of misses for B. Questions on how I came to this conclusion? Part of. Logic. Okay. So if we think of the overall performance effect, this isn't so great so far, but there's 2 things going on. So one is that, well, I didn't decrease the number of misses for for B, so I still kind of am dominated by this n cubed term, so wasn't so big. Also, I'm only doing this by decreasing things by a factor of 2, and it seems like I could have done more. In fact, I could have, but I chose instead of 2, I did 3 or something like that. So we need to think of how high can we actually go. But if I run this, I can like actually measure that we have fewer misses. Performance is more complicated. But what we'll do to sort of, you know, continue this idea is that we can say, well, the reason I didn't have any advantage with B is that the transformation I did didn't help with the problems we had with B, which is that B has horrible temporal locality right now. And a way we could help with B's horrible temporal locality is if we did the same transformation, but not with K, with I. So I just added doing the same thing with I that I did with K before. So I split up the I loop into 2 separate loops. I move one of them to the center. And if we expand out the center loops, we end up with something where we're accessing the same element of B twice. So now I should have that same divide by 2 effect for B. Questions on the sort of extending this transformation. So if we count our new misses, we've, you know, by doing both of these, by doing this extra transformation, we end up sort of reducing our misses in B. So we can continue, we can also apply this idea to the J loop. And we can sort of extend this to sort of do this idea that we're going to find ways to extract more temporal locality where we have bad locality, more spatial locality where we have bad spatial locality by doing this transformation. And we should end up decreasing our number of misses. And also, we could do it not by two, but by some larger number. So the general form we're going to get is we're going to have, you know, some loop where we choose some size, which I've called block I, j, and k, some sizes. We'll have to think about how we choose them. And basically, we choose a range of i's, a range of j's, and a range of k's. And we do the operation over that segment of i's, j's, and k's. And what we can think of this doing is that we're saying, here's this part of a, b, and c, based on those I, j, and k values, that I think fit in the cache. And I want to do everything I can with those things that fit in the cache before I move on to other things. So we're kind of organizing this computation into these blocks of these matrices, where we're trying to work on that block, those blocks of the matrices, trying to keep them in cache while we're working on them. And the way we'll keep them in cache is we'll work on them in chunks that fit in the cache. So for this idea to work, we're going to be choosing these blocks based on the i's, j's, and k's we choose, and these blocks should all fit in the cache. And the idea is while we're working on that block, everything should be a cache hit once we load the block into the cache. So the only cache misses we'll have are however it takes to load this into the cache just once before we move on to the next set of blocks. And by choosing these blocks of the matrices to be as large as possible, we should be able to get the best efficiency. So this gives us our general form. And the question is, sort of, how do we choose the sizes of these blocks? So questions on the sort of, this idea in general, this is called cache blocking, which I know is a confusing name because we have something called cache blocks, which are completely different. So cache blocking is kind of choosing sub-matrices to work on with the idea that those sub-matrices fit in the cache. And we sort of divide up our work into these sub-matrix units, scanning through the matrices with the idea that, you know, while we'll choose these units so we minimize the number of cache misses, hopefully. Questions on this sort of general cache blocking pattern? Yes?
Can you review what determines block I, block j, and block
k? Question, what determines block I, block j, and block k? So we've learned so far that sort of when we were doing these calculations, these twos here came from choosing two as one of those block sizes. So we want to choose the size as large as possible. But there's going to be some constraints. And a way we can think about it is as I make the number larger, like I have more of these iterations, more of these numbers, and eventually that's going to be too many, right? My cache, I can only have so many V values that I can assume will stay in my cache. So basically what we're gonna do is we're gonna have to choose the sizes such that when we think of all the things we're loading into the cache, they all have to fit. And that's gonna be how we choose those sizes. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? So sort of what we can think of is happening with this sort of idea is that when I choose my number of I, j, and k, you know, I'm going to work on, based on that I, j, and k, this is the block I, block j, block k, etc. I'm going to load that chunk of a, k, b, and c I'm going to have misses based on needing to access them once. And my goal is to make these blocks, these ijnk, as big as possible without overflowing my cache. So usually how I'd estimate that is I'd say, well, how big are they? How big are all these blocks that I need to have loaded together? And how much space does that take up versus my cache size? So what I might say for my desktop, for example, I have a 32 kilobyte cache. Maybe I'll look at the size of the L1 cache, assuming that's the one that matters, which may or may not be. And so I'd say, oh, if I use 48, that gives me about 27 kilobytes. That should fit in the 32 kilobyte cache. And that's where I'd start my guess as to what sizes would work best. Probably in practice, I'd figure out what sizes work best by trying a bunch. But this would tell me where to start trying this kind of calculation. And why I say you need to try a bunch is, well, because we didn't like account for conflict misses, for example. Also, I don't know that the L1 cache is the one that matters the most. But this is sort of how we'd apply this optimization. Questions on cache blocking? Okay, so that's on cache blocking. And our next topic is going to be some other optimizations for code that are not cache-based, but sort of based on looking at how instructions are executed. And we're going to mostly be looking at loops like we did for cache blocking because, well, loops are where most programs spend most of their time. And I'm going to start with this simple loop. So here I have a loop which sums up the elements of an array. And I have the compiled version, so you can see the compiled version here. This looks like pretty much like the best we can do. I initialize I and sum to zero. I check if check the while condition of the loop. I add values of I to the sum. I increment my loop counter. I go back to the beginning of the loop, check the condition. And you might say, you know, maybe I could probably make this a little better, but it's not clear that I can like reduce the number of instructions here other than maybe like figuring out some way of like not having a non-conditional jump and a conditional jump. Maybe I can just have a conditional jump. But there is a really common optimization which will reduce the number of instructions we run. But it won't reduce the number of instructions in total. And this is something called loop unwrap. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna do two plus equals operations in the loop. So here, I'm doing sum plus equals values of I, basically, with this add. What I'll do instead is I'll add values of I and values of I plus one. Now you might say, gosh, now I'm adding things twice. I'll avoid that by incrementing I by two instead of by one. So this transformation, well, I made the code bigger. Is this actually going to be better? Well, let's think of how many instructions actually get run. So in our first version, if I have size iterations, I have a loop with five instructions. So I have size times five instructions I'm going to run. With the second version, I have size divided by two iterations because I'm incrementing by two. And I have six instructions. So I have size divided by two times six. So if size is big, this should be a big benefit. So is there anything that I'm missing here? You know, maybe I should be handling that makes this not quite work. Counting four. Yeah. Okay, so you're saying if the size of the array is odd, I'm not doing the same thing I was doing in the original version. Yeah, that might be going out of the array. Yeah, so that's something I didn't handle here. So we need extra code to handle that. So question might be, is that still worthwhile? Well, it's probably not going to be worthwhile if size is really small. If like size is 3, that's probably not worthwhile. If size is like 100, probably even with that extra code to handle it being odd, it shouldn't be a big deal. And we should be running less instructions, therefore it should be faster. And I'm going to show this sort of as C code rather than assembly code for most of now on, just because it's simpler to for us to understand. So here's a version with C code that handles the leftover, so we have some extra if statement. That extra if statement, it won't be a big deal if n is like 1,000. It will be a big deal if n is like 3. But if we care about the performance, presumably we care about when n is like 1,000. Some questions? This transformation here. So this idea is called loop unrolling. We can think of like if we have our loop is rolled up, and you can like see one iteration, we're like expanding it, so you can see multiple copies of that iteration. And here I've done it by having just two, but like with cache blocking, this seems like something where we should have a benefit doing more. So we can do this, say, 4 times. So if I do it 4 times, this is sort of what the C code version looks like. My leftover handling, in this case, I just have a loop without unrolling to handle the 0 to 3 things that might be left over. And the idea is that, you know, as we do more, we should be saving more and more iterations. And why do we have the savings? Well, that's because in this case, a lot of the stuff for our loop, you know, all these instructions I marked here, they aren't actually doing the work of the loop, they're doing bookkeeping. So the advantage of doing loop unrolling is that when we unroll the loop, yes, we're duplicating the work of the loop, but we're not duplicating the bookkeeping. The bookkeeping stays roughly the same. We do need to make changes to it, but we can change the bookkeeping to be about as fast, but we have to do it less times, and that's going to be a lot better, assuming our size is big enough, and assuming that we like don't run out of like space for our code. Questions on this loop unrolling. Okay, so I've told you that this is faster, so let's look at some performance numbers. So I took sort of this example and I ran it on my laptop. I chose a sum array with 992 elements because I knew that fit in my L1 cache. So there would be, when I ran this, I set it up so there'd be no cache misses. Because we know the cache would kind of limit our performance, because memory's only so fast. And I tried this with a whole bunch of different amounts of loop unrolling. So I had the original version, which is labeled as one item of work per iteration. Then I had one with 2 items. So that's the first version I showed you. Then 4, and I kept going, did 8, 16, 32. So. And I measured the performance in 2 different ways. So one thing I measured is the number of instructions I took per element. And my laptop uses a processor that, like we mentioned at the end of pipelining briefly, it can do start multiple instructions per cycle and finish multiple instructions per cycle. So the number of cycles is actually per element is actually much lower, even though there's lots of instructions being run at once. Like this does more than just pipelining. It actually starts multiple instructions per cycle, which our pipelining processor couldn't do. And we can see, as I do more and more loop unrolling, even up to 32, I've had fewer and fewer instructions running overall, but my performance kind of plateaued. And it kind of plateaued at this value, which is about 1 cycle per element. And our textbook calls this value a latency bound. And what they mean by that is that, well, if I think of the calculation we're doing, I need to take my sum and add it, and then add the value I just got to something else. And each of those additions on my laptop takes a cycle. And I can't do one before the other one, so that's why we can't possibly do better than 1 cycle per element. It sort of seems. It turns out that there is a way to do better than 1 cycle per element. We'll talk about probably next time. But it's going to require some cleverness. We aren't just going to be able to rearrange the loop. Some questions on our loop unrolling performance. Our big next topic is we're going to look at how does the processor actually execute sort of multiple instructions at a time, And we're going to look at that from a perspective of, well, what do we need to know to know what's actually going to be faster and what's going to run into this sort of problem where we do some optimization that should help and it stops helping. Yeah. Question, aside from the size of the program, why isn't it best to completely unroll the loop? The size of the program is probably the main concern. And there are things that are basically related to the size of the program that are also a concern. And the reason why, I guess I should say, the reason why the size of the program is a concern, though, is because it will affect performance. Because our program, like, needs to be fetched. And when we're fetching it, we use the instruction cache. And if the instruction cache gets full, your program's going to run slower. So the code size like doesn't just affect the size on disk, it affects your actual performance eventually. So in this case, you can see it didn't start affecting my performance, probably because 32 adds in a loop, that's not actually much space compared to my instruction cache size. But if I like went up to all 992, probably that would be a problem. Yeah. Question, is loop unrolling performed by the compiler, or is it something that we should manually do? So we'll talk about later what compilers do and don't do well. But the summary of what we'll conclude there is that loop unrolling is something compilers can do, and it's very easy for compilers to do. The problem is that sometimes it doesn't help. And the compiler doesn't really have the information to know if loop unrolling would be helpful or hurt your performance because it would make your program very big and not help your performance and not like, but the loops don't run very much, for example. And you'll just have more cache misses, not much actual benefit. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So, I'd like to briefly talk about the relationship of loop unrolling to cache blocking, because it kind of looks similar, especially because I did this thing where I did cache blocking and loop unrolling to show you how cache blocking works. So let's talk about what loop unrolling looks like. So here, this is not cache blocking, this is loop unrolling. Why is it loop unrolling? Well, because if I think of what I'm doing here, I'm accessing C at I equals 0, 0, 0, then C at 0, 1, 0, 2. And that's the same thing that happens here. I access 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 2. I've just unrolled the loop in J. That's all I've done here. This is not cache blocking because the order of my accesses is the same. Therefore, my spatial and temporal locality is the same. The access pattern is exactly the same. I've just done it in a slightly different with slightly different loops, but I'm accessing the same exact elements of A, B, and C in the same exact order. So this is just loop unrolling. When we do cache blocking, we end up changing the locality. And commonly, I will combine that with loop unrolling. And that's a good thing to do, right? Because loop unrolling is helpful, and it's especially helpful when we get rid of all the loop bookkeeping, which is what we end up doing in this case. But that's what I've done here. So I've done cache blocking, then loop unrolling. So this is not just loop unrolling, this is also cache blocking because I'm changing the order versus with the code I started with of when I access A, B, and C. This top version has the change in locality, and then I added some loop unrolling. So this is cache blocking plus loop unrolling. So the cache blocking on top, and I added loop unrolling to it. Bottom, I get the same order of accesses, just with loop unrolling. And the reason I'm mentioning this is that commonly in an upcoming assignment, students will say that when they do this, they say, oh, I did loop unrolling in the K loop. And that's not what you did here. First, you did cache blocking in K, and then you combine that with loop unrolling. And yes, this is a great thing to do. This will help your performance because we're doing an optimization that improves how the cache works, and an optimization which proves how our loops bookkeeping works. So we should get a big improvement in performance. But this is not what would happen if I unrolled the K loop in our original version. So if I unroll the K loop in this version, the K loop's body is the loop over I. This is the body of the K loop. The loop over K in the original version. If I unroll that, I'm going to end up with something, something like this down here. Versus the cache blocking plus loop unrolling version here. And the big difference is the one at the bottom, well, looks really weird because it doesn't really make sense to unroll that loop. Because, you know, when it helps us a lot is when the body of the loop is really small compared to the bookkeeping. And that wasn't true. But what we wanted to do was this sort of cache blocking plus loop unrolling, where I just didn't write out the cache blocking step in this example. But this is if we unrolled the K loop. That's what this looks like, where I just have two copies of the loop body for K from the original. Versus this other version where I've reordered the accesses to A, B, and C by doing the transformation we discussed earlier, where I first split the K loop, move the split part into the middle, and then I unrolled that. So I had these two steps to get to that top version. Questions about this difference between cache blocking and loop unrolling? So cache blocking, when we're doing cache blocking or any sort of cache optimization, we're changing the order we access things. Loop unrolling doesn't actually change the order we do the calculations. All we're doing is changing the bookkeeping. And I think the reason why this causes confusion is that usually when we do cache blocking, combining it with loop unrolling is a great idea. But I just want you to remember that, you know, doing loop unrolling is not going to improve your cache performance. But if you're doing something that reorders accesses, well, you're not just doing loop unrolling, right? Loop unrolling, we still do the loops and iterations in the same order. We still do 0, 1, 2, 3. But when we went from, you know, this to this, that's not, we changed that order. We're not doing 0, 1, 2, 3 for K anymore on the other side. Questions about cache blocking versus loop unrolling? Okay, so when we talked about loop unrolling, we have this sort of latency bound, and we're going to want to talk about understanding like why that happens, how it happens. And to do that, we're going to have to talk about how out-of-order processors work. So we mentioned before that modern processors for targeted at like laptops and desktops and cell phones typically execute instructions out of order where they look for work to do. And out-of-order processors make hazards a lot harder to handle. So we're going to give you a very high-level overview of what the hazard handling looks like so you can understand, you know, what makes programs execute fast in an out-of-order processor versus slow. And the reasons that hazards are harder to handle, the biggest one is that if we think of forwarding, the forwarding logic we have for a pipeline processor doesn't work anymore. We can't just say, what's the thing in the last stage and expect that to work. So with our pipeline processor, if we had two values of R8 and we wanted to do forwarding, we just said, oh, we take the one in the first stage, earliest stage. So we take the one from execute instead of the one from memory, it's the best one. This idea doesn't work with an out-of-order processor. So here, with an out-of-order processor, the processor executed this add, and we have this arm move queue that is not ready yet. But it executed these other instructions that used R8 earlier, therefore. Or rather, it executed this other instruction that used R8 earlier, even before this add, presumably because like R10 was being loaded from memory or something like that. So this is something an out of order processor might do. And the problem is that if we just forward the value from execute to this second add here, that's a problem. That's not the right value of our array. We want the value that was just loaded in the fire move queue. So these out of order processors need to do some bookkeeping to handle this. And I'm going to give us a high level overview of what that bookkeeping might look like. Because we can't simply do the thing of, oh, take the value from execute instead of write back. That won't always be right if we're not running the instructions in the order they appear in the assembly, which we want to do in order to get more instructions to run. So sort of a basic idea we have for this is that we'll track the different versions of the registers. So what we'll say here is that this is producing R8 version 1, let's say. This is producing R8 version 2. And this is using R8 version 2 to produce R8 version 3. So we'll do that sort of bookkeeping. And then when we're checking where is R8, we won't check where is R8. We'll say, instead we'll ask, where is R8 version 2? And because we're asking where is R8 version 2, we'll know it doesn't make sense to get this value that's R8 version 1. It's the wrong R8. So this kind of idea is sort of how one of the ways, there's multiple designs, we can build one of these processors that doesn't run the instructions in the order they appear in the program. By tracking the different versions of the register values, we can, when we're doing forwarding, rather than checking, is it R8, we're checking, is it this particular version of R8 you have? And it also turns out that this will be helpful for figuring out, can we run the instruction at all? Because we'll check, is the right version of R8 available yet? If not, let's not start it. If so, let's do it. So the basic strategy for doing this is that our processor is going to have an extra step, basically an extra pipeline stage, where as part of fetching the instruction, we're going to add these version numbers into it. And then we're going to use that later on when we need to do things like forwarding to figure out what to forward, whether we can start instructions, whether we need to wait for something else, and so on. So as an example, you know, we're going to have some step where we take like this code which adds to R8 several times. And rather than like tracking what stage these come from, we're just going to rewrite the instructions to track what version numbers of values they use. And with the new versions of the instructions, it's much easier to figure out what we can forward. And we never have to worry about forwarding the wrong R8 anymore, because there's only going to be one R8 version 2. So we don't have to worry about having two different R8 versions 2s. There's an R8 version 2, it's the correct value. We don't have to do that forwarding priority thing we did in the HCL assignment. The cost is that we have to do this pre-processing step, which isn't very trivial. But out of order processor are going to do this, even though it takes some time. Another thing that version numbers are going to help us with is that with an out of order processor, we can often end up doing the write. If we do the write back in the straightforward order, we'd often end up writing back the old version before the new version. Having version numbers will help us avoid this problem. We can know to ignore the old version because we can compare the version numbers and figure out what's going on. We could also, more than actually only keeping the new version, typically, the out-of-order processors, we'll learn, the technique will be that we'll actually keep all the versions around. So the basic idea we're going to come up with is because we have these situations here where we might have a value of R8, we still need the old version of R8 for something we haven't started yet, and we need the new version of R8 for something else, what we'll do is rather than just keeping track of the version numbers and only keeping the most recent one, we'll actually keep copies of all the different versions of R8 that are still in use. So you might say, where are we going to put those? It doesn't fit in our register file. And the solution that out-of-order processors typically have is that they'll have lots of extra registers. So for example, my laptop, even though I'm running programs that use 16 registers, it has a register file on each core with about 96 or 100 something registers. And the idea is that each different version of a register's value can be assigned to a different slot in that big register file. And so this idea is called register renaming. So what we're going to do is we're going to take our original code that uses like R8, and we're going to rename R8 to a different real register depending on which version of R8 it is. So each version of R8 will have a unique name in this big register file with like maybe 100 plus registers. And this is going to simplify all our hazard handling, and it's going to be sort of the basic idea for how we're going to make a processor that can run these instructions in some weird arbitrary order. Is that basically we're going to track these each version of the register and use that information to know when can we start an instruction, where do we get the values for an instruction, where do we put the values for an instruction. That's going to be the basis of all our bookkeeping in these out-of-order processor designs. And we'll look at that more next time. So before I, questions on this sort of register renaming idea? Okay. So that's what we'll talk about next time.